Okay, Google, what does infra mean? Below. It means it's Latin for below. Welcome to Blue Dot, a look at our place in space. I'm Dave Schlom, along with co-host and engineer Matt Schiltz. Hello, Matt.
Hello, Dave. Thanks for having me.
Well, Matt, we have a new show. It's a little shorter in one sense. We've cut two words off the title, but a little longer format, a half an hour, more time to develop our conversations with our scientists around a common theme or a person and get to know them a little better as people and cut through some of the stereotypes that we all have about what scientists are like and what they do.
Blue Dot, Episode 1, Unlocking the Secrets of the Hidden Universe.
In the electromagnetic spectrum, which is all the wavelengths of what we astronomy types call light, visible light is the one that humans can see. Red, orange, yellow, green, blue, violet. Okay, those are the colors of the visible rainbow. That's what we see as humans. Below red is another kind of color that we can't see, and that's called infrared. We don't see it, but we feel it. We can feel it as heat. And that's what infrared is. And infrared is the key, I think, to unlocking the secrets of the universe. And we're going to talk to somebody today who has been at the forefront of unlocking those secrets.
And who might that be?
Amy Mainzer, astrophysicist from NASA's Jet Propulsion Laboratory, and she's an expert on infrared astronomy. Amy, for our listeners that may not be real familiar with what infrared actually is, what is infrared?
Well, infrared is a type of light. So it's just the same as the visible light that your eyes can see, but it's of a longer wavelength. So what that means is it's light that's actually redder than the reddest light that you can see with your eyes. Human beings actually perceive infrared light as heat. And when you feel the sun's warmth on your skin, what you're actually feeling is infrared light from the sun, and it interacts with your skin, and you feel it as heat, but you don't see it with your eyes.
Just tell us a little bit about how did you first get interested in infrared astronomy?
Well, for me, it was certainly something that I didn't really know much about growing up. And I didn't really learn about it until I actually graduated from college. And when I was at my first job with Lockheed Martin, that's when I learned that they were working on a project called the Spitzer Space Telescope. And this is an infrared space telescope. And that was really pretty much my first exposure to it. But it was really amazingly clear that this telescope would be able to see a lot of really great stuff and would be a really great asset to the science community.
Now, you've done a lot of engineering work. Can you tell us a little bit of, didn't you design one of the cameras for one of the space telescopes?
Yeah, that's right. So the project I worked on at Lockheed on the Spitzer Space Telescope, which is, like I said, an infrared space telescope, was actually a sensor for it, a small camera, roughly the size of maybe both of your hands put together, that actually tells the telescope how to point and where to point. So it's a sort of a, we call it a fine guidance sensor. It basically helps the telescope to point better. And it does this by looking at stars and making very precise measurements of where they are. And that allows us to basically figure out which way the telescope is pointing to very high accuracy.
When did you first, as a young person, start becoming interested in science?
Well, I happened to get interested in science at a really young age, at about 6 or 7, and it was really just kind of something I stumbled on, I suppose, a little bit by accident. I actually got started reading kid books about Greek mythology, and I remember looking in an encyclopedia when I was a very little kid and stumbling upon the sort of alternate meaning of a lot of the Greek myth words, so like Andromeda. Andromeda is the name of a mythological character, but it's also the name of a galaxy. And if you look that name up in an encyclopedia, you get both definitions. So I remember seeing some of the pictures of things like the Andromeda Galaxy in the encyclopedia and thinking, wow, that's really interesting. What is that?
What do you think is the most challenging thing for a young person, you know, choosing a career path in the sciences and in any STEM field? Because it is difficult. What do you think is the hardest part?
Well, in my experience, actual work in the scientific profession is really kind of different than the classes would sort of portray it. The classes are often, especially when you get to the college level, there are a lot of problem sets. You mean you have a lot of, every week you've got to do a bunch of problems and turn them in, and then you have tests and so forth and so on. And it can be kind of a grind sometimes. And what I find is that real life is not at all like that as a professional scientist. It's a much more free-form and collegial and collaborative kind of field than you might expect when you just take the classes in college. And so I think for a lot of people, they maybe have a bad math class or something where they have a really bad time, and that sort of puts them off of the subject forever. And that's really unfortunate because it's really not like that as a professional. It's quite a bit different.
Let's talk a little bit about what it really is like. What do you think is one of the biggest misconceptions that people have about scientific work?
Well, I would say a lot of the sort of stereotype of the scientist is somebody, you know, working by themselves late at night in a lab somewhere, never talking to another human being. In my experience, that's not the case at all. I mean, yes, there are definitely times when you kind of want to go off and work by yourself and think, but most of the time, it's really collaborative. It's about teamwork. Most science projects these days are done by, you know, people working in groups, with sometimes really large groups, and it's a lot of fun. It's kind of like if you played on a sports team or something like that, and, you know, it's just the camaraderie and the teamwork and joking around and, you know, all the things that kind of make an activity fun. That's what working in science is really more like. So in a lot of ways, it's really not like the experience of the classroom sometimes where it's just sort of a very repetitive grind of problem sets. It's really much more freewheeling and fun.
Let's go back to talking about infrared astronomy. Why is infrared really, I think it's one of the key ways to unlocking the secrets of the invisible universe. Why do you think infrared's such an important tool?
Well, all the different wavelengths are really important tools for learning about the universe. The way I think about it is it's like approaching any sort of project. You know, let's say you want to build a desk. You need a bunch of different kinds of tools if you're going to be able to build a desk. You need saws, you need hammers, you need, you know, tape measures. I mean, you need a lot of things. And each one contributes something different. And it would be a lot harder to build a desk if you didn't have, say, a hammer. So for us in astronomy, all the different wavelengths are just different tools. And they each bring something different to the table that allows you to make a different kind of measurement or learn something that you otherwise wouldn't be able to learn. So infrared is just one of the many tools that we have out there for learning about the universe. And this particular tool is useful for a variety of different reasons. Because it's a wavelength that's longer than visible wavelengths of light, it has some unusual properties. It can go through things like dust clouds very well. Visible light tends to get blocked by big clouds of dust. And if anybody's ever seen a picture of the Orion Nebula or the Horsehead Nebula, these are beautiful, famous pictures in astronomy where you can see a kind of a big dark blob in the shape of a horse's head. Well, that dark blob is made out of dust and gas. In visible light wavelengths, that's enough to completely stop the light from going through. So what we see is a dark blob silhouetted by glowing gas. But if you look at that blob with infrared light, The dust can't stop it nearly as well. So what we can see is what's happening on the inside of the dust cloud. And in this case, there are new stars that are being formed inside the Horse's Head Nebula. So it allows us to see inside these really dense clouds of gas and dust. We can see what's going on. That's one big benefit. And there are others, too.
You've worked on two really fantastic instruments, Spitzer, the space telescope that sees in infrared, and WISE, the Wide Field Infrared Survey Explorer. Can you explain to us, you know, how the two instruments are alike and different from each other?
Sure. So the Spitzer Space Telescope is a little bit larger than the Wide Field Infrared Survey Explorer. It's about 85 centimeters across. So for a space telescope, that's pretty big. It's not as big as Hubble, but it's up there. It's a decent size. Now, WISE is smaller. It's about 40 centimeters across. And, of course, with a telescope, the size of the mirror kind of gives you an idea of its light-gathering power and how well it's going to be able to pick things out in the sky, its resolution, if you will. But in this case, the Spitzer Space Telescope, because it's bigger, it kind of comes with a trade-off. It's more sensitive, and it has more light-gathering power, but it has a smaller field of view, meaning the region of sky that it can see is just narrower. It's littler. Whereas the WISE mission doesn't have quite as much light-gathering power as Spitzer, but it has a much larger field of view, meaning it can see a huge swath of the sky all at the same time with just one exposure. So these two telescopes are therefore highly complementary to each other, meaning you've got a wide-angle fisheye-type lens, and you've got your zoom lens. And it's nice to have both, because if you have your wide-angle lens, you can use that to find the things that are the most interesting in the sky, and then you can use your zoom lens, which is in this case the Spitzer Space Telescope, to zoom in and find out more about those targets of interest.
What would you say are some of like the greatest hits of the two instruments, some of the great observations or discoveries, things that we've found using those two instruments?
Well, the Spitzer Space Telescope was designed a long time before exoplanets were first discovered. And that's, that one of the great surprises of the Spitzer Space Telescope is that it was actually able to take pictures of an exoplanet and learn more about its atmosphere. That was a pretty amazing discovery for a telescope that was never designed to do that. And as always with astronomy, you know, it's kind of the case that sometimes we find the most interesting things that we were expecting to find. And then other times there are the surprises, things that, you know, the original designers of the mission had no idea would be possible. So I would say the Spitzer exoplanet discovery and characterization work was really something spectacular that just wasn't in the plans before it was launched, or rather even before it was designed and built. So, that was pretty remarkable. Also, for WISE, this telescope was designed to survey the entire sky in infrared light. And, of course, one of the things you really wanted to look for with it were kind of the most unusual objects that you could find in the whole sky. That's a good reason to do a big survey like that. So we were originally looking for things like extremely cold stars that kind of span the boundary between what makes something a star and what makes something a planet. And we were also looking for a type of extremely bright galaxy that shines because it's forming stars at a huge rate. Those were the original two science goals. And the telescope has of course, fulfilled both of those beautifully. But there was another topic that we knew that it would probably be useful for, but which really, I think, panned out in spectacular fashion, and that was the ability of the telescope to see asteroids. Asteroids are very, very bright at infrared wavelengths, because they're a lot cooler than the stars. They're kind of room temperature or colder compared to stars, which are thousands of degrees. And that means the asteroids really stick out brightly at infrared wavelengths. They glow. And we can see that with the infrared telescope. So WISE is actually able to spot quite a number of asteroids and measure the heat coming off of them. And that, in turn, allows us to measure how big they are, their size. So that was pretty cool, and in my opinion, a really fun discovery that came out of the mission.
And you were the principal investigator for NEO-WISE?
Yeah, so in fact, the asteroid thing worked out really well, and so well that NASA actually came to us after the mission, the primary mission was over, and they asked us to restart the spacecraft, to take it out of its hibernation phase that it had been placed into when we finished the successful prime mission. And once it came out of hibernation, we were able to continue to use it to look for asteroids, and we're still doing that today.
You're listening to Blue Dot on North State Public Radio. Back in a moment with our conversation with astronomer Amy Meinzer. Thank you. And we're back talking with Amy Meinzer on Blue Dot. I just saw that there's a new proposal that has been one of the ones that NASA is looking at for NEOCAM. Can you tell us about that?
Sure. So this is a mission that's proposed to go out and search for asteroids and comets at infrared wavelengths where they're really bright. But this time, rather than using a telescope that really wasn't originally designed for that purpose and had some limitations, now we want to do the mission with a telescope that really is designed and optimized from the get-go for finding what we call near-Earth objects. These are asteroids and comets that get relatively close to the Earth's orbit, that sort of come into the region of space around the Earth. So WISE has done a wonderful job at spotting asteroids and in its restarted mission, which we now call NEO-WISE, or Near-Earth Object plus WISE. It's still finding and characterizing a lot of asteroids, but it's really intrinsically limited in what it can do because there are some real hardware limitations on the project. And, of course, eventually it's going to end because the orbit was not originally designed to last a whole lot longer. So eventually it's going to become non-operational, this time for good.
Where will the camera be put? What kind of orbit will it be in?
So unlike WISE, NEOCAM is designed to go a little farther away from the Earth. It's designed to go outside of the orbit of the Moon at a place we call the L1 Lagrange point. And what this is a region of space that's just outside of the Moon's orbit that is basically kind of what we call a semi-stable point, meaning that if you put a spacecraft there, it's going to hang around that region of space without using a whole lot of energy to keep it there. The reason we like that is that it's far enough away from the Earth that the heat of the Earth won't overwhelm the telescope, but at the same time, it's close enough to the Earth that we can get pretty high data rates and get all the data back. Everybody who has a cable modem is familiar with what happens when you have a slowdown in bandwidth when you're trying to watch your favorite show, right? It sort of starts to get pixelized, or sometimes it'll even drop the signal. It's the same thing for us. We're designing an instrument that has about 32 megapixels on it. And we want to be able to get all of the data back as fast as we can so that we can sift through all of the images and pick out the very faint asteroids moving through the images. So to do that, we want to stick pretty close to home. We don't want to get too far away, because the farther away we go, the smaller the data rate, less data we can send back in a given amount of time. And the other thing, of course, as I mentioned, is the heat. The Earth is hot, and both WISE and NEOCAM and also Spitzer, these are infrared telescopes, meaning that they're sensing heat from faint, faraway things like asteroids and stars. So if you're near the warm Earth, it makes it harder. In the case of WISE, it's not impossible, but we had to keep the instrument cold so that we could pick up the heat from the faint, distant objects. We actually had to carry solid, frozen hydrogen, which is really, really cold. And as you can imagine, it's not the easiest of materials to work with. It also runs out.
Yeah. What are some of the principal scientific goals for NEOCAM? Searching for asteroids that could have implications for hazards to Earth?
Yes, NEOCAM is designed to search for and characterize near-Earth objects, so the asteroids and comets that get close to the Earth. And we want to find out, you know, how many there are, what their orbits are like, how big are they. We also want to find out a little bit more about them. We want to find out, where exactly do they come from? How do they get to where they are today? What will happen to them in the future? And exactly how do all the asteroids in the main belt get there anyway? So, you know, most of the asteroids in our solar system, in the inner part of the solar system, are in a big belt between Mars and Jupiter, which we call the main asteroid belt. But the question is, how did those asteroids get there? And exactly how do asteroids make their way from the main asteroid belt to the region near the Earth? I mean, if you think about it, the asteroids in the asteroid belt have stayed there for literally billions of years. So how is it that some of them manage to leak out and get close to the Earth? And those are some of the questions that NEOCAM is designed to answer.
In addition to that, is there the thought that you can potentially survey targets for exploration?
Well, that is a possibility that we hope to be able to explore. I mean, if you think about it, an asteroid that's making a close approach to Earth it's something that you want to pay attention to because you want to make sure that it won't hit the Earth. But objects that get close to the Earth are also ones that are energetically easier to get to. In other words, you don't have to expend as much propellant to be able to reach an object that's making a fairly close approach to the Earth. So you could imagine that, these are places that might be good to explore because it doesn't take as much energy to get to them as it would be to more distant objects.
Well, we're to the point in our show where I like to call this Matt's question. Matt, is there a question you'd like to ask Amy?
Yeah. Hey, Amy. I was looking at all of the NASA Discovery proposals, and there's a couple others that study asteroids and a couple that will send something to Venus, and NASA will pick one, maybe two. And I'm curious if there's sort of a competition, what the atmosphere is between the different people and the different proposals, how that works.
Well, Discovery is a line of competed missions, meaning that many teams propose, and then NASA selects between the different projects. And they have a variety of different categories. Some of them are, you know, the technical ability to produce the mission, the scientific, the likelihood of scientific success, meaning that your chances of being able to do what you want to be able to do. And then also what we call programmatic balance, which means, you know, the question of priorities, you know, which are the things that we think are the most important to do at a certain point in time. And NASA has to balance all of those things. And, of course, above all else, the cost. These are a line of cost cap missions, meaning that they have a certain dollar value that you cannot exceed. So the challenge here is to provide a mission that will do great science, but on a budget. And, you know, the Discovery line has been extremely successful. There have been almost a dozen missions so far, and they've almost all of them produced outstanding results. They've really done very, very well as a line of mission. So we're just happy to be able to get this far in the competition, and we're working hard on it.
But the NEOCAM team isn't like, Psyche, what a bunch of chumps.
Oh, no. Think of it this way. This is a great honor to even get as far as we have in this competition. All of these missions are fantastic, and I wish we had the money to do every single one, because these all are going to really cool places, studying amazing things, and they're going to do great science. I mean, our big problem with Discovery is that there's so many good ideas and only a small amount of money. Well, not small, but it's a finite amount of money. If I had my druthers, I would pick them all. I really would, because they are good, and they're interesting, and they're worthwhile, and we would learn so much from doing all of them. That's, I think, the hardest part that NASA is going to have to do. They're going to have to choose between a lot of really cool things. And, you know, if we had more money in these programs, we could select more. But we're at least lucky to have a program at all.
And
that's how I feel about it.
I saw that the NASA budget that just went through is a bit better than it has been in the last few years. If you were talking to taxpayers, which you are right now, people listening, what would you say? What's the value in doing this kind of research and exploration for all of us?
Well, I would say, first of all, thank you. Thank you to all of our taxpayers for investing in a forward-thinking research program that involves space. It's an absolute honor to get to do this kind of work. And we think it's of great value because we learn so much about ourselves. We can learn how often asteroids hit the Earth, for example. We can start to figure out which ones we want to pay attention to. That's another thing. But also, every human being at some point in their lives kind of wants to know what's over the next hill, you know, what's out there. That's kind of an innate human drive, and that's what doing this kind of research allows us to learn about. It basically is a way of learning more about the universe, but also about ourselves. How did we get here? What's going to happen to us? And it definitely gives you a perspective about life on Earth. I mean, when you spend a lot of time looking at asteroids, it really makes you appreciate the nice green view that I can see when I go out my door every day. Plants and atmosphere. That's pretty amazing if you think about it. It's easy to overlook it, but when you spend most of your time looking at deep space, the Earth looks really wonderful.
That was beautiful. Which brings me to I'd just like to ask you a couple of questions away from the world of astronomy, because I like for our listeners to get a sense that, you know, you guys are people just like everyone else. What kinds of things do you like to do when you're away from work, when you just don't want to be thinking about work things? What are some of the fun things that Amy likes to do?
Well, I really like gardening with California plants because I live in California. And of course, we're undergoing this humongous drought right now. So it's really, really, really hard to plant anything that isn't able to deal with the drought without using a lot of water. So I've been gardening with these plants, and everybody thinks, oh, that must mean cactus, but it doesn't. It's actually leafy green plants. It's just the plants that live up on the hills and mountains in California. They're really well adapted to dealing with the drought. So I've been having a lot of fun kind of turning the place around me into a little native plant garden. That's been a lot of fun.
Can you give us a couple of Amy's recommendations for our native plant gardeners? What are a couple of your favorite plants?
If you're a Californian, any kind of sage. California sages, black sage, white sage, Cleveland sage, purple sage, they're all fabulous. They smell great. You can cook with them, and they use hardly any water at all.
Oh, fun. And do you have a nice place to garden where you live?
I have a little yard, yeah. I like it.
There's nothing, I don't know, there's nothing better to me than more relaxing than just working in your own yard.
Yeah, there's something really nice about being outside, of course. I mean, nature has a wonderful way of helping you forget about your problems a little bit. One of the other projects I've been working on the side lately is a show for PBS Kids, and it's a show about space for little kids. It's called Ready, Jet, Go, and I really hope people like it.
What's it going to be like? Give us a sense of what it's going to be.
Well, it's an animated series, so it's basically a cartoon, and it's about a little alien kid who comes to Earth with his parents, who are intergalactic travel writers, and he basically just tries to blend in with the kids in the neighborhood, and he meets a bunch of friends, and they travel around, and they have all kinds of adventures just in the backyard, but also traveling through the solar system. It's really fun, because basically the kids get to learn about science, but it's a fun show. It's got a lot of songs, and it's done by a guy named Craig Bartlett, who is the creator of a show called Dinosaur Train for PBS.
And that's going to be on PBS?
Yeah, that's right. It'll be airing, I think, starting February 15th.
Is there a website that you could point us to for people to check that out, especially if they got kids?
Yeah, if you just look up Ready, Jet, Go, it should be on your local PBS station website pretty soon. In fact, it is out there now. But the new episodes are going to start streaming online, and the show will premiere on air on February 15th.
Now, I still like to watch little kids' programs.
Me too. It's really fun to get to think like a kid again.
Oh, certainly. We all should. Amy, thank you for spending the time with us today. I really appreciate it.
No problem. Thanks so much.
It's Dr. Amy Meinzer from NASA's Jet Propulsion Laboratory in Pasadena on the infrared universe and life working on Spitzer and the WISE telescopes. Blue Dot's a production of North State Public Radio. Visit us at mynspr.org. Follow me at Dave Shlohm, and I am reminding you that from deep space, we all live on a pale blue dot.